From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Coming up, is there a connection between what's happening now in Yemen and in Iraq?
We'll check on that. But first, let's get to the latest on the crash of German Wings Flight 9525 and the shocking announcement today from the chief French prosecutor handling the investigation into that crash that the co-pilot brought down the plane intentionally after locking the pilot out of the cockpit. The co-pilot is a 28-year-old or was a 28-year-old German national named Andreas Lubitz and was recorded on the plane's black box, calm and not saying a word as the plane went down. And this morning, the French prosecutor, heard here through a CNN translator, stopped short of calling the co-pilot's actions terrorism or suicide.
So far as I know, there's no camera within the cockpit to film the co-pilot, but we don't get the feeling that there was any particular panic because the breathing remains steady.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joins us from Paris with the latest on this. And Eleanor, what more did we learn today about what happened during those final minutes on that flight?
Well, basically, the prosecutor gave us a blow-by-blow account of what happened in those final minutes, and it was very shocking. They reached cruising altitude, and it was a normal flight. Apparently, the pilot and co-pilot were in a normal conversation about different things. The pilot asked him to take over while he excused himself. You hear the door shut, said the prosecutor. And at that point, he said everything changed. He immediately took the plane off of automatic pilot and began to manipulate the buttons which make the plane descend. Now, he stressed that this cannot be done accidentally or involuntarily. He said it means turning a button several times. Then he said a couple minutes later, the pilot knocked on the door to come back in. And since the September 11th attacks, there's a new system on cockpit doors. They have, you know, they're steel enforced and you have an alarm system. Anyway, he showed who he was, but the co-pilot didn't let him in.
I was just going to ask, are investigators saying anything about whether there was a motive, if indeed this is what happened?
Well, this is now the question, that what could be the motive? Because at some point, you never heard another word from the cockpit, like you said, and you just heard his steady breathing. At this point, the Marseille control towers are calling up to him. They're asking other planes to contact the plane, to please put the plane in peril signals on, because the plane is going down rapidly. And he doesn't say a word, to the point even the altitude alarms go off and the pilot is slamming on the door, screaming at the end. He never says a word and it just plows into the mountain.
What more do we know about this co-pilot and his training? We know that he was 18 months out of flight school.
That's right. The CEO of Lufthansa spoke today at a press conference. I mean, they are absolutely shocked, Carsten Spohr. And he said right now, German privacy laws, medical privacy laws, he doesn't know why he was out. But he said he came back and got the proper training to get up to speed. He made it clear that Lufthansa had absolute confidence in this pilot and that he had all the necessary training, psychological checks, and everything.
Yeah, well, actually, we heard from the CEO, as you said today. This is Carsten Spohr. Let's listen to what he said. Here he is speaking through a translator.
We have a very high-flung and sophisticated selection procedure. Later on, during the training and later on also during his professional life, the person is observed.
And as you say, Eleanor, there have been questions about the kind of screening procedures and psychological testing that has to go on with these pilots. But you're saying Lufthansa, they say that they did everything as they should have.
Oh, absolutely. It was, you know, they had an impeccable safety record, Lufthansa. You know, everything is being reexamined now. They're talking about never should. Some companies, airlines already say one person cannot remain alone in the cockpit. And they're saying, analysts are saying that's pretty much probably going to be throughout the industry now. They're going to require two people be in the cockpit. A lot of things might change. The locks on these doors might change. We're going to see a lot of changes. But right now, people are just in a state of shock. They cannot understand why this man would have done this. And this news has broke just as hundreds of these family members have reached the space. And I'm watching on French television, you know, they're huddled on a field by a makeshift memorial under this mountain. And they all know what has happened now. And German Chancellor Angela Merkel spoke. She said, I wish I could talk about this accident like I did yesterday, because she was there yesterday. She said, but it's a crime. She called it a crime.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joining us from Paris with the latest on what has turned into perhaps an even more terrible story than it already was, the crash of German Wings Flight 9525. Eleanor, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Saudi Arabia has suddenly become a main military force in the civil war that is racking Yemen. Today, Saudi and allied warplanes are bombing key military installations in Yemen. It's an effort to oust the Shiite rebels who forced Yemen's president to flee. The airstrikes are supported by several countries, including the U.S., but the American military is not involved in the airstrikes over Yemen. Sebastian Usher is the BBC's Middle East analyst. Sebastian, what is it about the situation in Yemen right now that has motivated the coalition led by Saudi Arabia to take action?
I think there's several things. One is just a neighbor that is already a very difficult one. You know, it's not the kind of neighbor that you want to move in next door to you, Yemen, but I mean, it's got a lot worse. So they want to reinstate some kind of stability in the country. Whether these airstrikes will achieve that, obviously, is a very big question. They also want to forestall this Iranian influence. I mean, I think they've overstated that to some extent, but as time goes on and if the situation deteriorates, that will become a much bigger factor. And also they want to ensure that a very important route for, you know, oil tankers and so on through the Gulf of Aden is kept under the control of a state, of a government that is friendly to them. And they obviously feel the Houthis wouldn't be, and that would endanger that route through the Gulf of Aden up to the Suez Canal. So they felt they had to act right now as the Houthis were closing in on the president, Mr. Hadi, and looked as if they were just about to take over the whole of the country. So these airstrikes were launched within hours of that happening.
Okay, if we look at the players here, Saudi Arabia is leading this coalition. The United States is, as we said, not involved in the airstrikes in Yemen. Why are both of those things the case? Why is the U.S. not taking part in the airstrikes? What are the U.S. concerns there? And why is Saudi Arabia taking the lead role?
I don't think the U.S. at this stage has any reason to be involved in the airstrikes. I mean, the Saudis and the other states that are involved, other Arab states, other Gulf states, have more than enough in terms of planes to carry out these attacks. As far as the U.S. is concerned, I mean, it's made, perhaps wrongly, but it's made its focus in Yemen always about al-Qaeda, jihadists, and keeping a lid on that. And I think that will remain the priority of the Americans. And again, what they want is to ensure that Yemen doesn't descend into a completely failed state, which would then allow the jihadists, and this isn't just al-Qaeda, but possibly Islamic State now, to build on what it already has as a power base in Yemen. As far as the Saudis are concerned, I mean, they have long, I mean, you know, Yemen is the poorest country in the Arab world. Saudi Arabia is perhaps the richest, their neighbors. Saudi Arabia has always called the shots or wanted to call the shots in Yemen. It's seen in the past year or so that ability to control Yemen and to control events there slip out of its hands. So it doesn't want that to happen. It obviously felt that it had reached a critical stage where it actually might see Yemen be taken over, they say, by groups that are so hostile to Saudi Arabia, and also with the potential of Yemen becoming so unstable and impossible to control that it will become a much bigger problem than the Saudis have faced in the past with Yemen.
Sebastian, one final question. At the same time that the United States is watching most carefully what's happening in Yemen right now, again, not involved in the airstrikes, though, the U.S. is hitting ISIS targets into Crete in Iraq, trying to push back ISIS once again, which has been largely in control of Crete. Is there any link between these two things, what's happening in Yemen, what's happening, what the U.S. is doing in Crete?
Well, there's an irony, I mean, which I think isn't lost on the people in the region and the Americans aware of. But I mean, in Yemen, they're siding with the Saudi Arabia coalition, which is attacking what's seen as an Iranian backed group. And of course, in Tikrit, it's now, I mean, it held back for some time. It's only now finally committed itself to backing with airstrikes this major offensive by the Iraqi government against Tikrit. But, you know, the main reason everyone assumed that the Americans hadn't been involved in that was because the Iranians, through Shia militias, which are the dominant force in this offensive, and Iranian military commanders are calling the shots there, and that they didn't want to. The Americans didn't want, and the Iranians to some extent, and the Shia militias didn't want to mix that clearly, that visibly together. So you've got two very different battles that are going on in terms of the alliances, which almost seem diametrically opposed to each other. But in a sense, it's for a similar reason from the American perspective. It's to try to stop the rise of jihadists that the Americans see, and obviously many other countries do, as the major threat coming from the region. So in Iraq, and to create its Islamic State, in Yemen, it's trying to stop the country descending into the kind of chaos which would help not just al-Qaeda, but potentially Islamic State to build and have more power there.
Thank you, Sebastian Usher, the BBC's Middle East analyst, speaking to us from London. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The U.S. soldier held for nearly 5 years in Afghanistan as a prisoner of the Taliban is facing charges of desertion and misbehavior before the enemy, which carries a penalty of possible confinement for life. Sergeant Bo Bergdahl left his post in 2009. He was released last May in a controversial prisoner swap. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Jessica Robinson reports from Bergdahl's hometown of Haley, Idaho.
I'm standing here on Main Street in Haley, and a year ago, you could have looked up and down the street and seen yellow ribbons on every tree and lamppost in honor of Bo Bergdahl. But things have changed since last May, and now many longtime supporters say they just don't want to comment and attract more attention to the town. For many years, it was almost the opposite. People in this town of about 8,000 in south-central Idaho made it their mission to spread the word about the POW. They organized letter-writing drives to the president and planted trees in the city park for each year Bergdahl had been held captive. There was an annual rally that brought hundreds of veterans on motorcycles from across the West. Then in May, Bergdahl was released. The Obama administration traded him for 5 prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, though without consulting Congress. On top of that, Bergdahl's release was accompanied by details about the strange circumstances of his capture. Former members of his unit said he had deserted and walked off into the Afghan mountains. Bergdahl's release was initially a moment of celebration in Haley, but within days, the town had canceled an event to honor Bergdahl. Organizers said they'd received threats and worried the celebration would attract protesters. This week, the Army formally issued its charges against Bergdahl.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for coming to Fort Bragg today.
Colonel Daniel J.W. King told reporters, Bergdahl has been charged with desertion, which has a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment. He's also charged with misbehavior before the enemy by endangering the safety of a command, unit, or place. King says that charge has a much higher punishment.
Possible confinement for life.
After that announcement, the mayor of Haley issued a statement. It said the town would take no position on the Army's case. The town of Haley was quiet again. A dirt road just outside of Haley will take you through the canyon where Bergdahl grew up. Bergdahl's parents have remained silent since his release. There's a chain around the front gate and no answer on their phone. Minna Kasser sits at her dining room table in her home just down the road from the Bergdahls. She remembers Bo as the neighbor boy who taught her daughter fencing in the garage. It was around noon on Wednesday when Kasser got a text about the charges.
And was actually at lunch with some friends, and we were all, everyone at this point, I think, wasn't too surprised by something finally coming out, and yeah, people have been waiting to find out what's going to happen.
Kasser says they always knew Bergdahl's case would be complicated. And now that the Army is calling it desertion, some people in Haley agree he should be court-martialed.
I know that there's some people that are pretty upset and angry, but a lot of people, because he's from our town and he's a young man, and people make bad decisions and people have a lot of challenges in life, and there's a lot of area between complete black and complete white.
Kasser says she's happy Bergdahl's return has been a relief for his parents. Desertion charges, at least, are an improvement to where Bergdahl was a year ago. For Here and Now, I'm Jessica Robinson.
The NCAA basketball tournament resumes tonight. The feature game pits the top seed in the tournament, Kentucky, against West Virginia. The Kentucky Wildcats are undefeated, and they're the favorites to come out on top when March Madness comes to an end. If they do, they'd be the first team ever to end the season with 40 wins and no losses. Mike Pesca is Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. And Mike, do you think that's what's going to happen, that they will end up undefeated?
Well, you know, if you look at the statistics, the advanced statistics, no team is more likely to win. But when the tournament started, there was something of an odds-on favorite. There's been a bit of a recalculation. They haven't exactly blown out their first two opponents. In fact, against Cincinnati, they looked a little human. Things like shooting from afar, not doing as well as they had done during the regular season. So now I would say that they're, not just me, websites like 538 put it at a 41% chance that Kentucky will win. I can't really conceive of anyone else doing it. And just watch. They'll go out and, you know, they'll crush West Virginia tonight, and no one will even think that 41% was realistic. But yeah, it is Kentucky as the dominant team in the tournament still.
And, you know, some people were saying on the first day of the tournament, we talked to you last week, that Thursday was the most exciting day ever in the NCAA tournament. How do you think this is shaping up after we've been in it for a little bit now?
Every first Thursday is the most exciting day ever. Well, I think that early on there were these two – when we talked on Thursday, there were these two upsets of a three-seed losing. Iowa State and Baylor both went down, and we had the specter of Georgia State, R.J. Hunter hitting a three, his dad falling off a chair. We all fell off a chair. The nation fell off a chair. But now if you look at it, there hasn't been too many. There have been a few other upsets. Number two-seed Virginia lost. Number one-seed Villanova lost. So that has happened. I think it's exciting even without the upsets. I mean, I really do like this tournament. I like how close the games are. And so it might, you know, every year we hype ourselves into saying it's never been better. It's been a good year so far.
But there are no real Cinderellas this year.
No, no teams who are, you know, a Georgia State who gets through, or a Dayton a couple of years ago, or a VCU, or a George Washington when they made it to the final. Those are Final Four teams. We're not going to have that this year.
Why do you think
we
that
have kind
is?
Of basketball? I think we have basketball powers. I think Wichita State years past, just by their the fact that they don't play in the strongest conference and that they are Wichita State, would seem like a shock, notwithstanding the fact their nickname is the Shockers. But it has been, I think, in Wall Street, they call it priced into the system. So a lot of the teams that we might be shocked with then, we're not shocked with now. And even teams like Xavier, where one of their best players is an Uber driver to earn money to pay his scholarship because he gave his scholarship to his brother. Teams like Xavier used to not be in power conferences. Now they're in the Big East. So you factor that all in, and we're saying, oh, look, teams from power conferences are there.
Uber or UberX? Do we know?
I don't know. We don't know. Maybe he'll speak at the TEDx conference.
let me ask you, though, Mike, about the women's tournament also before we let you go. The top team, Connecticut, plays Texas on Sunday. I was looking. The Huskies in Connecticut have won 9 NCAA Division I national championships. They've advanced to 15 Final Fours. Are they the women's version of Kentucky, basically?
No, they're much, much better. I mean, Kentucky would love to be in the – any team ever would love to be in the position that Connecticut's in. Those UCLA teams under Wooden were probably not as favored and as dominant. And even though Kentucky has – even though Connecticut, UConn women have a loss on their season, man, they have not come – no one has come close to putting up any numbers on them. In fact, the website 538 did a story where they quoted me – because I observed, I've never seen a close Kentucky, a close UConn game this year. And they looked at the numbers and they said, like, with 10 minutes left, their average margin of leading in the game was 40-something. Huh. I do predict they'll play a close game. I do predict that they will not get a loss.
Something in the water in stores. Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
So the question we ask now, how did we get here? How did the men's NCAA tournament become such a big deal? Here and Now's Alex Ashlock takes a look.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our New York studios and the NCAA Basketball Championship Selection Show.
These days, the NCAA basketball tournament is all about your bracket in the office pool. So you might be surprised to know there hasn't always been a selection show. The tournament games haven't always been televised wall to wall. And March Madness is a phrase originally used to describe the high school basketball tournament in the state of Illinois.
There's only 5 seconds left to play. There's nothing going to happen now. Hebron is the state champion of Illinois.
March Madness was coined by Henry Porter, an official with the Illinois High School Association. He wrote an essay in 1939 in which he said this: a little March Madness may complement and contribute to sanity and help keep society on an even keel.
Villanova led both times at the half, but then Patrick Ewing and the Hoyas pulled it out.
Sportscaster Brent Musburger often gets credit for applying March Madness to the NCAA tournament in the 1980s. But you can go back and watch entire games from that era, and he seldom uses the term. The first NCAA tournament was played in 1939. There were only 8 teams in the field. And in those early days, the NCAA wasn't even the most glamorous postseason basketball tournament. That label described the National Invitation Tournament, the NIT, which was played in New York's Madison Square Garden, the basketball mecca.
Virginia Tech wins the NIT at the final buzzer with a shot by Bobby Stevens. Unbelievable!
It was during the 70s that the NCAA tournament started to feel pressure because only conference champions made its field. There were no at-large bids like there are today.
We thought we had something really, really special. And all we had to do was win the ACC, win two games, and then we're in the Final Four. And that's where we felt we would meet Lew Alcindor and the UCLA Bruins.
Bobby Kremins was the senior co-captain of the 1970 South Carolina team, the best team in the Atlantic Coast Conference during the regular season. But South Carolina lost in the ACC's postseason tournament final game and didn't qualify for the NCAA tournament. It was situations like this that basically forced the NCAA's hand. So in 1975, the field was expanded to 32 teams, and at-large teams were included for the first time. That set the stage for what the tournament is today, with a field of 68 teams. But the real numbers behind all of this are $10.8 billion. That's how many dollars the NCAA gets for the TV rights to the games, under a 14-year deal signed with CBS and Turner in 2010. That's a kind of March Madness Henry Porter never could have imagined when he coined the phrase in 1939. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Today, the U.S. Census Bureau released a list of the nation's fastest-growing metro areas. The beaches and sunshine of Florida stole the show. Now, you might not have heard of the Villages. It's a retirement community just west of Orlando, and it was the fastest-growing city in the United States. The population jumped more than 5% in just 1 year. In fact, Florida happens to be home to 6 of the 20 fastest-growing metro areas. NPR business editor Marilyn G. Wax has the big picture now. Marilyn, what did this census report show generally?
Well, it showed that Florida certainly is booming again. Real estate, it had a very tough time there during the worst of the recession, but the economy's improving, and most of all, baby boomers are aging, so the state is attracting a whole lot of new residents. And in fact, Florida now, it has nearly 20 million people, so it's shot past New York, and it's the third most populous state. It's behind California and Texas. And the thing that's interesting about it, there's two things to me. One is that it's so spread out. It's like the whole state. Those other cities are Miami, Fort Myers, Tampa, Jacksonville, Winter Haven. It's all over the state it's growing. And the Villages, they're sort of in the center of the state. It's become a magnet for boomers. And the second thing that impresses me is that Florida has a lot of people who die. You know, it's a lot of older people there, and about half of the counties report more deaths than births. So you really need to attract a lot of people to overcome the losses from those deaths, and they're doing it.
Yeah, they're doing it, not only from in-migration within the United States, but also people from overseas who are coming to Florida to retire as well. Well, not everybody wants to go to Florida. What are the other big hot spots in the past year around the United States?
Well, when you look at a map and you think about it, basically anywhere the sun shines a lot, you're going to see more growth than when it's...
And I bet you'll be seeing more and more after this winter.
Right. Cold and cloudy is not selling for retirees. Right. So you've got warm weather cities, Charleston, Austin, Raleigh. That's where it's growing. The places where it's dropping population is Detroit, Cleveland. And if you think about these last two winters, as you say, you know, really a lot of people kind of fed up with snow, so that trend may accelerate. And, you know, a lot of retirees, of course, they do want to be near their relatives or their old friends, but a lot do want this better weather, and that has implications for the broader economy.
What are those implications? I mean, one thing, of course, there needs to be more senior housing, presumably, and senior services in some Sunbelt cities.
Well, that's what we've got, a country with a whole lot of two-story houses in the Snowbelt, you know, and what we're going to need going forward is more senior-friendly one-story homes in warm weather states. And there's another thing that I think is really important to consider, that one of the reasons people move to the Villages in Florida is they don't want to be mixing it up with tractor trailers on an icy freeway in Michigan. You come to the Villages and you can get in a golf cart and go to the store. So you can still be mobile even though you're not maybe a great driver anymore. So there's some pretty big implications there for infrastructure and, of course, for the workforce in general.
Okay. Thank you very much for the latest on the U.S. Census report and where in the United States, so what cities and communities are growing and which are not. Marilyn G. Wax, Senior Business Editor for NPR. Nice to speak with you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Today, Indiana Governor Mike Pence declared a public health emergency in one of the state's southern counties after a spike in new confirmed HIV cases. Health officials are calling it an HIV outbreak, and Governor Pence has authorized a short-term needle exchange program for Scott County, despite his opposition to implement the program statewide. Scott County is located about 30 miles north of Louisville, Kentucky, and we go there now to speak with Brittany Combs, the county's public health nurse. Brittany, why is this being called an outbreak of HIV?
An outbreak is an abnormal amount of positives. Normally, our county every year reports less than 5 new cases of HIV every year. And as of right now, we're up to 79 since January.
Well, and health officials are attributing this to needle use and people using the drug Opana. What is that, first of all?
Opana is an opioid pain medication. It's prescribed by doctors for pain. It's highly addictive, and these people grind up the pills, and then they inject it. So it's IV drug abuse.
And how big of a problem is it in the county?
It has been a big problem in our county for years. And actually, our Opana numbers have gone down, and then, of course, the heroin goes up, because when one goes down, something else goes up. But our doctors really don't even prescribe it anymore. So the Opana is coming from out of the county somewhere, and we're unsure of where.
And do you have a sense of how HIV got brought into the mix in such quick fashion here, that so many people clearly have contracted it and are now positive for it just in a matter of a few months?
That is one of the things that we're trying to figure out, is exactly where it started. The theory is someone with an acute case of HIV came into the county and shared needles with someone else. That person became an acute case then. When somebody has an acute or a newly diagnosed case of HIV, it spreads more easily. So they shared needles with someone else, and they got it, and they shared needles with someone else, and they got it. A lot of these people go in the same circles, and then they all do needle sharing, and that's how it spreads so quickly.
So the governor, Mike Pence, who, by the way, is an opponent of needle exchange programs, is going to authorize one in your county only. That's the only county in Indiana where this will be allowed. Is that the kind of thing that's going to make a difference, do you think?
I don't think it'll make a difference with the drug addiction, but I think it'll make a difference with the HIV spreading. And that is, like, my main goal right now, is to stop the HIV from spreading. And then we have a long road ahead of us trying to take care of the actual drug addiction.
Although some people have said this is not enough. It should be a statewide needle exchange program, or it should go on longer than just a month, which is what the governor is proposing.
That's something that we definitely need to look into. I know there's a lot of people in the state that are pushing for it, and Kentucky actually just passed their laws saying that they can have a needle exchange program now. So we're hoping that maybe Indiana will kind of take charge of that now and say, well, Kentucky's doing it, and maybe they'll show that it helps, you know, their drug addiction, and maybe we can get that down the road.
As you've been dealing right on the ground level with this public health crisis in Scott County, have you learned anything that other areas should know about how they might deal with something like this?
This is a public health nurse's worst nightmare. It's an outbreak that I can't stop because of the mode of transmission. We've been trying to stop IV drug abuse for years, and so that's nothing new for us. But I can't just go snap my fingers and everybody quit doing IV drugs. You know, drug addiction is an illness itself. And then on top of that, you know, you've got the HIV on top of all that. So the other problem is that when there's an outbreak, usually it's a virus that wears itself out. There's an end point, and there's no end point for HIV. These people have HIV the rest of their lives. But as long as we can get these people in treatment, they can live decades, but it's getting the people in the treatment and keeping them in the treatment long term.
Brittany Combs, who is the public health nurse in Scott County, Indiana, which is currently fighting an HIV outbreak that has apparently been fueled by people exchanging needles to do this drug, Opana. Brittany, thank you for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
When most people think famous American writers and think Key West, Florida, they think Ernest Hemingway and the house with all the cats thought to be ancestors of Hemingway's cats. But Ernest Hemingway only lived on the island for 6 years. That was back in the 1930s, and it was off and on. So all this month, Key West is celebrating the birthday and the legacy of another major 20th century writer, one who lived there a lot longer. Nancy Klingener from Here and Now contributor WLRN has our story.
Tennessee Williams died more than 30 years ago, but the man who wrote A Streetcar Named Desire and The Glass Menagerie might still recognize Key West today.
He went to restaurants that we can go to today. He shopped at the grocery stores we shop at today.
Dennis Bieber is the founder of the Tennessee Williams exhibit in Key West.
So many people still have stories that they can tell about running into Tennessee, drunk maybe, or in a bad mood, and how coarse he could be, and that Southern attitude could be so sweet and endearing one moment and really throat-cutting the next. But that's what made him part of our community.
Some verse read for the Key West Library, most of it early and young by an old man.
Tennessee Williams made this recording in 1971. He wrote the poem as a young man, and it was never published.
The wayward flesh has made me wise in many things I should not know. Perhaps if hawks tore out my eyes, your image would not plague me so.
Key Westers have been celebrating Tennessee Williams and the years he spent on the island all month, with poetry, painting, and film screenings. And they created a new production called Tennessee's Rose. The staged reading draws from stories, journals, and plays, all focused on the playwright's relationship with his sister, who was also his muse.
I would barely notice my sister at the piano, groan at her repeated blunders only in sympathy for him.
In this scene, young Tennessee watches his sister rehearse for a recital with the young man who was his first crush.
There must have been a shocking conflict in my thoughts and sensations as I gazed down upon him.
Williams first visited Key West in 1941 and bought a cottage here in 1949. It was his home base until he died in 1983. But the cottage, unlike Hemingway's house, is still a private residence, not open to the public.
He liked the freedom. He lived very quietly. Hemingway is so famous in Key West with a very large house. Tennessee lived very modestly.
Developer David Wolkowski helped transform Key West into a high-end resort during the decades when Williams lived here. And they were good friends. Wolkowski had a restaurant on the beach. One time, Williams brought dancer Rudolf Nureyev to lunch there. Then the playwright went off for a swim and didn't return. When Nureyev was ready to go home, Wolkowski found Williams napping underneath the building.
I said, go back to sleep, and I took Nureyev back to his house.
When Dennis Bieber takes people on tours of the Tennessee Williams exhibit, there's one question he gets a lot.
Well, what did he write here?
Bieber says Williams wrote and rewrote bits and pieces of just about everything in Key West, including a play you've probably never heard of.
Will Mr. Merriweather Return from Memphis?
The play was the first production at the Tennessee Williams Fine Arts Center in Key West when it opened in 1980. It's the story of a woman waiting for her lover's return, even as she counsels her daughter to resist a man's advances. But Williams pulled the play after 2 weeks because he wasn't happy with it. And it hasn't returned to the stage, at least not in that form.
Because the estate will not allow it because he said he never rewrote it.
The exhibit also includes a section about Williams' partner, Frank Merlo. In the 50s and 60s, two men couldn't easily be a public couple.
Everybody in Key West knew it, but the big world in general wasn't really accepting famous people being gay.
Officially, Merlo was Williams' assistant.
But he was much more than that. He did everything for Tennessee. He set up his interviews, he fixed his dinner, and he lived with him for 15 years.
The exhibit in Key West started 4 years ago for the 100th anniversary of Tennessee Williams' birth. Now it's permanent. And it gets bigger every year, with connections to the Tennessee Williams Festival in New Orleans and even the National Gallery in Havana, which currently has a show of Williams' paintings. No plans yet, though, for a look-alike contest. For Here and Now, I'm Nancy Klingener in Key West.
Maybe you're one of the many people who have reason to celebrate the recent strength of the U.S. dollar, especially if you're planning your summer vacation abroad. But a stronger dollar also pushes down inflation, according to Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen. Greg Ipp is the chief economics commentator for The Wall Street Journal. He writes that if today's low inflation persists, the fight against the next recession may be tough. Greg, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
Okay, might be helpful for a little bit of economics 101. Low inflation sounds pretty good. Why is that not the case in your view?
Well, it does sound good, doesn't it? I mean, who doesn't want low inflation so that their dollar goes further? But just remember, if your employer can't raise the prices of the things it sells, it probably can't raise your salary either. So over time, low inflation, high inflation, it doesn't really affect what your purchasing power is. But what it does affect is the ability of the central bank to manage the economy. Over time, if inflation is very low, so will interest rates. If you look at Japan, for example, over the last 20 years, inflation has been zero or slightly negative. And throughout that period, interest rates have been stuck at zero. That leaves the central bank in a situation where if a bad shock or a recession comes along, it can't lower interest rates to help the economy. In the case of the United States, if the low inflation that we have today persists over the next 4 or 5 years, eventually there will be another recession. And in that situation, the Fed would probably have interest rates only at 2 or 3%, which is really not much ammunition for cutting them and therefore cushioning the economy from that recession.
Okay, but the economy has been growing steadily in the United States. Unemployment is now at 5.5%, pretty low compared to what it has been. All of this usually suggests higher inflation. Why is it still low?
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that even though unemployment has come down a lot, it's still above the lowest point it reached in the last expansion. And we know there are a lot of people who are unemployed, but they're not being counted as unemployed because perhaps they gave up looking for work. We know there's a lot of people who are working part-time, but they'd really like to have a full-time job. So there's a lot of slack, as we call it, out there in the labor market, which is putting downward pressure on wages. And that's one reason prices are also not going up.
So how does this challenge the Fed then?
Well, the Federal Reserve has a delicate task because the law says it's supposed to aim for both full employment and stable prices, and it defines stable prices as an inflation rate of 2%. If the economy behaves as it normally does in a business cycle, then eventually unemployment will get down to a level where all the workers who want jobs can find them, and then they can start asking for higher wages because there aren't a lot of unemployed workers around to compete with. As that happens, you'll start to see those higher wages feed through to prices. If the process continues long enough, then you will actually end up with an inflation problem of inflation over 2%, maybe over 3%. And then the Federal Reserve is in a situation where it says, well, we wanted inflation to be back to normal, but we didn't want it to reach runaway levels. And so suddenly they'll have to hit the brakes as they have in the past, and perhaps that causes another recession. So it's got this delicate job here. It doesn't want to raise rates so quickly that it aborts the recovery and puts us back in a recession. On the other hand, it doesn't want to hang around with this cheap credit for so long that it creates a latent inflation problem somewhere down the road. So it has to somehow balance those two competing interests.
And how well would you say right now the Fed is balancing them?
Well, I'd say that they're doing quite well, given all the curveballs the global economy keeps throwing at them. A 5.5% unemployment rate, it's higher than we would like. But if you compare to the 10% that we had in 2010, it looks pretty good. Inflation, yes, ideally it should be higher. But on the other hand, big drop in oil prices was unexpected, and it's probably actually good for consumers and growth in the near term. The stronger dollar is definitely causing some problems for exporters or companies that compete with imports. If you're a California winemaker, you're going to be competing with a lot of cheap French wine in the next year. On the other hand, that strong dollar is the flip side of a weak euro. The weak euro has been very good for Europe, and in the long run, a stronger European economy will be good for the United States.
Okay, and how about, as we mentioned in the beginning, the prospect of overseas travel for Americans, say, over the summertime? How is this all affecting them?
Well, the euro is a lot cheaper, so if you've been hankering for a long time to take that vacation in Italy or France, this year is as good as any. It may be that the people who operate hotels or resorts in Florida or Cape Cod will miss your business, but that's the way the global economy works.
For those who don't necessarily follow economic news, but again are affected by everything that happens in terms of inflation, what should they be hoping for?
Well, I think the thing that most people out there ought to be hoping for is for the money they earn to go further. And that can be a combination of two things, the things they buy getting cheaper or their paychecks getting larger. Ideally, what you would want is business to be so good that their employers are paying them more, giving them bigger base pay raises, bigger bonus checks. That's a kind of a win-win game because it means that both the workers and the people that sell those workers those things are benefiting. Really, a strong economy and a virtuous circle of economic growth is when not just prices are rising at a normal rate, but wages are doing even better. That's kind of been the missing link. We just haven't had those strong wage increases up to this point. When people out there are starting to get nice increases in their paychecks, that will tell us that things have finally turned the corner.
Okay. Good to talk to you. Greg Gipp is the chief economics commentator for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks again, Greg.
Pleasure to be here.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins, in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.